They say marketing is a madman's game. So now we turn it over to the marketing madman with Nick Constantino and Trip Jobe on Extra 106.3 FM.
Happy Saturday and welcome to the Marketing Madmen. Nick Constantino here, and I was throwing a curveball this morning, so we're going to roll with this curveball. So I have two gentlemen with me, Joe Chucci of Duane Morris LLP, an attorney, and I have Tom McCorkle of Anzi Real Estate, a realtor. So they know each other. I didn't know they knew each other. So now they walked in, screw it, we're doing it together. And for the record, they both look like they got some stories. So we're going to continue the conversation offline and have some fun after this. So you're going to get the radio version, but make sure to tune into the podcast because you're going to get the extended version. So first off, Joe, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing great this morning. Thanks for having us.
Tom, how you doing?
Doing fantastic. Thank you for having me. Happy New Year.
Thank you. And we braced the cold to be down here. It is, I know we'll air this in February, but it is about 20 degrees in Atlanta, and Atlanta does not do well. We have a storm, and yes, I'm throwing air quotes up, because the kinds of storm that come are either 1/10 of an inch or the whole city shuts down, and 1/10 of an inch actually shuts the whole city down. So we'll see what happens on Friday, but thank you for braving the cold to be here. Joe, so obviously, let's rewind. Let's not go where you are now. Talk about growing up, where you went to school, how you got to the point you are now.
Well, we're sitting in Atlanta. Yep. I don't have much of a Southern accent, although I've lived here since 1998. I'm originally from Michigan.
Okay.
My wife and I moved here in January of 98 from the Detroit area.
Okay, so you know cold.
We know cold. In fact, when we left Detroit.
You don't know winning football, but you're seeing it now for the first time, which is nice.
This might be the year of the Lions.
Where's the wood?
This might be the year of the Lions.
These drumsticks that you got me are the wood, so I'm knocking.
Yes, so born and raised in Michigan. Went to undergrad at Alma College. Went to law school at the University of Detroit in beautiful downtown Detroit.
Okay.
Practiced law there for 5 years and then moved to Atlanta with my wife. Didn't know a single person. We literally moved because we had a snowstorm in Detroit in October of 1997 and said, there's got to be more to life than shoveling snow in October. So yeah, here we are.
There, awesome. 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 So lawyer the whole time? By trade?
Lawyer the whole time. I have no idea how or why I ended up as a lawyer, but I've been playing lawyer for 32 years now, but 19 plus years at the Duane Morris Law Firm, which is a Philly-based,
yep,
big general practice firm, and I do employment litigation and all the things that employers get sued for, we get them out of trouble.
Yeah, and I have to imagine the listings of things and cases you have to try have just grown over the past decade or so, because now that I've gotten to management, I swear someone looks like they're going to sue me every day, and I'm so good at keeping records, it's not going to happen, because I took my LSATs and was this close to being a lawyer, so whatever conversations we have, they get the follow-up email, hey, just to reiterate, in writing, so I cover myself, but I have to imagine the list of things people are getting sued for has gotten exorbitantly bigger.
It's there's new and interesting things every day.
That's a very lawyer way to put it.
You just never know what's going
to
happen.
That's a very lawyer way to put it, Tom. And so a realtor, but not by trade for your whole life. So give us your background also.
Yeah, quite unlike Joe, I had a very varied background,
okay,
in history. Always knew I wanted to be into sales of some sort. I grew up in Charlotte,
okay,
North Carolina. Went to NC State.
Okay.
I'm a raging Wolfpack fan, even though we've had a horrible year this year in football. Everything else
coming off a
great.
Good year the year previous.
Yeah,
I don't know what
great
the hell
year
happened.
Previous,
good basketball
Final Four
year last year. Yeah.
Last year,
yeah.
So it's been encouraging.
What was that? Where did that big dude with the ponytail, the big guy that looked like he should be playing basketball? Did he end up playing in the NBA?
He's not in the NBA. He's in the developmental league in Europe.
Okay.
Forgive me, I can't remember.
I mean, he was unstoppable. I mean,
yeah.
I've never seen a guy that you knew wasn't going to play in the NBA be so unstoppable.
And he's likable.
Yeah,
and he was
him.
Approachable.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
It was a marketing coup because we hadn't had that since Jimmy Valvano.
For sure.
And who I was a big fan of. I was there when he was there.
Cool.
We won the national championship in '83. And that's one of the reasons I got to Atlanta. And we had the national championship run. Before that, me and a bunch of fraternity brothers piled in the van to go to Fort Lauderdale on spring break. And we stopped in Atlanta in Buckhead.
Yeah, you almost have to. People don't realize when you're driving 75, 85, have to come through Atlanta. Most cities, there's a way, Philly, there's routes around it.
Yeah.
You have to come through Atlanta, and there will always be traffic because of 16 lanes coming into 5.
Yep.
Like, it's because it was poorly planned. It's not because there's people. It's not because everyone likes to drive. It's because it was poorly planned. Carry on.
We stopped here and looked at each other. There were like 8 of us in a van. Thought, we're in Buckhead.
Yeah.
Why are we leaving here?
Yeah.
We eventually did after a couple of days, but I knew I wanted to come back to Atlanta.
Yeah.
And so moved back here years later, was in construction sales, always wanted to be in sales, and then got in the medical business. sold medical devices for a while, and was in Florida, came back up here to work for a company selling implants.
Yeah.
I thought, hey, that's going to be fantastic, selling implants in Atlanta, until I got here and found out it was not implants I thought.
Yeah.
Penile implants.
Different thing, completely.
Yeah, completely different. So we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
I didn't see that coming.
That'll
be part of the offline conversation.
I told you I knew Joe, so we can get into that later.
There you go. That's how it is. Joe with the penile implant. All right. He likes sticks. We know that.
There we go. And from there, some out of the blue, got a call from Coca-Cola one day, and they were looking for people with varied backgrounds, which I certainly had. I had interviewed with their VP of sales husband for another medical job. And they wanted me to move to Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
I didn't want to do that. I wanted to stay in Atlanta. Just bought my first home and accepted a job with Coke. And I spent almost 26 years in the beverage business.
Yeah.
Soft drinks, and then moved into alcohol beverage.
Cool.
Worked for several different companies. Okay. But started selling real estate about 15 years ago.
Okay.
And knew I wanted to do it. And then COVID hit, and it was just time. I was tired of traveling.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm a single dad, special needs son. I thought, you know what? I want to stay in home. And I was selling more and more and more real estate. And then just happened from there. I thought, you know, I'm staying off the road and changed careers at a ripe old age, and I've loved every minute of it.
Yeah. You know, when I meet people, when they start, I knew I wanted to be a salesperson. I know what the story that's going to tell is going to be varied, and it's going to be an all over the place thing.
Yeah.
Because one of the things about salespeople, my personal thing about sales is people ask, how are you good at sales? And I say, don't listen to what anyone else tells you. If you don't come into sales with a diversity of experience behind you, you will never succeed. And the reason is, it's about building rapport. And if you have something in common with someone, that rapport is built overnight. And the only way you're going to have rapport with somebody is having to be well-traveled, have diversity in what you like, what you see, what you do. If you don't, there's no way to build rapport if you don't, you know, you say the Marlin on the wall, right? Every one of my guys, they want to bring people here.
Yeah.
Right? You guys see, it's a gorgeous office. We're in the middle of the battery. I love bringing people here. But you know what you don't see here? The Marlin on the wall. You don't see what the guy does in for a living and what they have and how important the family is. You don't see that. So go out. So, you know, I love salespeople. I think it's a conversation we always have about, is it better to be a marketer that learns sales and a salesperson that learns marketing? And the answer is you can't be trained to be a salesperson. You have to have it in you. You have to know it, and you have to pursue it. It's easy to train someone to be a marketer. So real quick, and then we'll go back to Joe. So you've been in real estate now, you said about 15 years. What do you like? Four years
full-time. But I started, so I was doing everything wrong for 8 or 9 years. You know, wrong, illegal, there's just not knowing.
Yeah.
You know, you get your real estate license, and then you realize, okay, I got my license, but I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah. I know, so I have access to the MLS.
That's all I know.
You can
find
a house. What's your favorite thing about being a real estate agent now? Now that you've got your bearings, you have your feet under you, what's your favorite thing about doing it?
Far and away, helping people find their dream home or seeing how excited they get when they get a great house. Case in point.
My wife and I included.
It's just fun. I love doing that. You know, we have ups and downs,
You
know, and anything. But I think that's what I really excel at, is managing those relationships and expectations.
Yeah.
And letting them know, hey, look, this is one of the biggest decisions you're going to make.
Yeah.
Let me help you with that. Let me help you find the right place. And also, more importantly, help you weed out the wrong places.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that, because COVID really screwed a lot of that stuff up. But
And speaking of COVID and Tom, you know, when Tom switched careers, you know, he was going to walk away from where he was. And I said, no, you're not. We're going to help you get a little package on the way out the door. And he did it the right way, approached him the right way, and it worked out. And then the segue into real estate, you know, when Tom was talking about how you help people, you know, I think we helped you.
Absolutely.
And for all the right reasons. And then when we looked for lake houses, we had looked at a zillion of them, walked in, and Tom said, yep. I looked at my wife and, yep, that's the one.
There it is.
But he helped us through that.
There it is. And that's the relationships. And that's what it is. And I have to imagine, because of what you do in employment law, there's probably times you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm stuck with this case. But there's also times you're like, oh my God, I just saved somebody. I saved the company. I gave advice that helped. And again, look, life, one of the things that is so hard, everybody seems like they're out for themselves. And if you watch, that is really not the case. If you have two smart people that are looking for mutual benefit and they can get all of that crap out of the way and put on the table, hey, here's what you're going to achieve. Here's what I'm going to achieve. We cool. Most
partnerships and most things are easy to accomplish if people are transparent and speak.
Yes.
It doesn't happen that way, but it really is not so hard. It's what people, and it's, I don't know if it's a northern thing coming down here, but people are just very passive aggressive. They don't want to have the hard conversations. And like, just rip the freaking Band-Aid off, dude. I know it's going to hurt, but the longer you take to rip it off, like every time, you know, I got hairy arms, I'm Greek and Italian. I pull a Band-Aid off, it hurts. But if you pull it slower, it just hurts for more for longer. Rip the Band-Aid off.
And that's probably how you felt when you finally left where you were, you know, to go where you
are. It's a big deal to make a really nice salary, income, bonus package to zero.
Sure.
So, you know, if I'm not selling, I'm not eating. And so,
But at the same time, that first off, that fire is going to differentiate you from everybody else in that industry, because it tends to be a lot of housewives that just one day are like, I'm going to sell real estate. Yeah. And that got weeded out when there's not as many houses on the market, obviously. True. And I think we'll go into a little bit more detail, because I'm curious a lot about the beverage industry during COVID. You know, I know a lot about the alcohol industry. I've been with the guys for a long time. And, you know, what they thought was going to happen during COVID ended up happening now. They thought they were going to trade up. Trade down during COVID, but they actually traded up during COVID, and now everyone's starting to trade down. So, you know, needless to say, we are in interesting times. All right, so Joe, before we go to break, you're also a drummer, so which will probably set the stage for a lot more of these after-hour conversations. But talk a little bit about the music upbringing, when you fell in love with it, and then what you're doing now with it.
You know, I started playing as a kid. My grandfather got me started.
Yeah, your mother loved you for that, right?
Yes. So my mom and dad allowed me to do it, but my grandfather, same name, Joe Chucci, was a prominent drummer in the 30s and 40s. I actually still
have Jazz, big band?
Big band drummer.
Love it.
I still have his drum kit, played all the way through college. I was a mediocre D3 linebacker, but half of my college was paid for by playing the drums in the college jazz band, and then didn't play for, call it 20 years, probably played the drums five times. In 2011, I was told that I had kidney cancer.
Oh.
Took out a tumor, half my right kidney. They told me that it was benign. But as a result of that, my wife, St. Laura Chucci, is always right, said, you need to get back into playing drums. You need to do something you love for 5 minutes a day.
That was the, you're annoying me. Go find a hobby.
Yes. Exactly. And
you have too much free time.
Yeah, absolutely. So literally made this kid's year at Guitar Center, went in and bought a drum kit. 2 days later, I'm playing drums in a band with a neighbor and another neighbor. That band, you know, we recorded an album and then formed another band with the bass player, Navajo Joe, which, by the way, was a Burt Reynolds movie.
Love it.
Spaghetti Western is how we got that. But went from not playing at all to getting to open for the John Driscoll Hopkins Band and playing a lot of venues that, you know, we sell them out. We don't sell them out because we're a Grammy-winning band. We sell them out because it's Jeff Seward, Dean Seward, and me on drums, because we do charity shows. So if 99 out of 100 of our shows are charity shows, so we've probably raised with friends and clients close to $500,000.
Love
it. And that's what it's about.
Love it.
Because people can tell your motives are pure when we're doing it.
And it's authentic and it's organic. It doesn't exist anymore, especially with Live Nation. We'll get into that conversation.
Yep.
But we're going to go to a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. Nick Constantino here with Joe Chucci and Tom McCorkle. And we are going to do what I usually do in the last segment. We're going to speed it up and do it now. So we're going to play advice you would give your younger self, or advice people you would give to people entering into these industries. And we're going to have lots of industries to cover. Okay. So if Tom, with you, we're going to do real estate and sales. Joe, with you, we're going to do musician and lawyer. Okay. So that's a far ranging things of advice. But
got it.
Joe, let's start with you. So obviously, if you're starting to play the drums, have a good relationship with your parents so you don't drive them crazy. But correct. What advice would you give to people, to musicians who are like, am I good enough to make it? Because you've built a career, you left it for some time, but you said how important the charity is and almost not taking yourself too seriously. What advice do you give to somebody who's 15 years old, playing the drums and thinks they can make a living out of it?
Well, in terms of drums, I definitely don't take myself too seriously. And I think that it goes a long way, because I've been able to become really good friends with what I call the real drummers of the world.
Okay.
Rich Redmond of Jason Aldean, or Daniel De Los Reyes in the Zac Brown Band, or doing work for the band Skid Row.
Okay.
Elaborate on why those are real drummers.
So when I call them real drummers, because when you look at their, or Chris Fryer, the Zac Brown Band, when he's very proud to say after a number of years, when he clicks occupation on his tax return, it says musician or drummer. If I did that, I would be living in a van down by the river, not what I'm doing now.
Sure.
So when I say
real drummers, career, when I lifetime
say
the, drum.
When I say the real drummers,
they found a way to make a living out of being drummers.
Yes. Okay. A hobbyist like me, which is if looking at those folks is if you want to be a drummer or a musician, you need to do it because you love to do it.
Yeah.
Whether you're they have the best chops or, you know, you can stay in the pocket and play. If you're going to do it for the right reasons.
Yeah. And practice and practice and rehearsal can't feel like practice and rehearsal. It has to be something that you love.
Yeah. You have to do something that you love. So I'm stealing what those guys have said to me. And again, I use Rich Redman as an example. Is he's been with Jason Aldean since day one when they were four guys in a bar and six guys in the band. It's the same guys. But you look at what he's doing, they're on their eighth or ninth album.
Yep.
But he's doing a podcast. He's giving drum lessons. He's hustling his hiney off.
Yeah.
And all those guys are.
Yeah. So, but they do it because they love it.
They
not
do
necessarily
it because
they need the money. The benefit of is the exposure. It expands your reach. It separates yourself just from Aldean and from the star name. It separates yourself from that. But he's doing it because you're loving it. You're not doing a podcast to get, I promise you, before anyone's listening to the podcast, you're not doing it to get 85 million people in money. It just doesn't exist out there. So you're doing it to expand your reach.
Yeah. He's expanding his reach, and he'll still come back to his core of, I love what I'm doing. And, you know, I have a CEO of a big client who have said, you know, gets up on stage at a charity show and he's like, you know, we pay that guy Chuchi and his firm millions of dollars a year. He's a better drummer than he is a lawyer. To which I'll say, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And again,
backhanded compliment or?
You know, so no, but when you're talking about being a lawyer and I'm doing a lot of employment litigation or business litigation where there's a lot of high stakes, there's a lot of emotion, you know, whether it's a sex harassment case or a discrimination case, there's a very intense, a lot of emotion. So when these clients and friends see me play the drums and they're like, I've never seen you so happy. You're grinning from ear to ear. I mean, you see me, our band, we just get up there and you grip it and rip it. No one's calling you. No one's texting you. No one's emailing me.
Yeah.
So when I'm back to your initial question of what would you tell a younger self or somebody who wants to get into the quote music business, do you really love it?
Yeah.
Do you really love it?
Yeah.
And if you do, then just keep doing it.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point about like self-awareness. So one of the things, I was young and I was a bass clarinet player and I liked it. Like I liked the act of playing music. It was cool when you finally got good enough that you can play a song. But like I didn't love it. Like I was too busy doing other things at 13, 14 years old, chasing girls and doing all that stuff that I was like, it's a saxophone. Who gives, you know, had I known how to seduce a woman with a saxophone, probably would have been a different thing.
It's not too late.
All we had was Kenny G staring at us. He's not seducing anybody. So it threw me off. So what about now? Obviously, we're talking more complexity about being a lawyer and in what you do. But let's go back to the early years, right? Litigation has changed. Lawyers have changed. The advertising has changed. You can't turn your head without seeing a big face on a billboard.
Yes.
But to lawyers starting out, what advice would you give? Or to your younger self?
Well, in a bit of both. I mean, yesterday I'm with the CEO of the Georgia Association of Manufacturers. Great guy. And he's asking me to meet with his daughter, who is a younger lawyer, to mentor her. And, you know, I spend a lot of time mentoring younger associates. And I'm back to, because it's a grind.
Yeah.
You want to build so many hours. I mean, it's that, you know, we're all on that treadmill running. And I'll hit stop and go, because it's when I'm giving that advice, it's also to me helpful because it makes me want to take my own advice, which is, do you enjoy what you're doing? Because I have some colleagues that, God bless them, they love the law and they love talking about the law and the newest case. That's not me. So what I would say, I'm back to a young lawyer. I was thinking about this yesterday when two super smart, very wealthy people, you would know the company, you would know the people. I'm back to, it's still humbling to me when they call and they say, we have a problem. We need your help. We want your advice.
Yeah.
And that's what I remind young lawyers of. And they'll get that when given the opportunity, when somebody says, I have a problem, I need your help. Help me fix this, help me avoid that. And again, that's what I have to remind myself of. That's what's been meaningful about the practice of law.
Yeah.
And it did change in COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, it got crazy. It got different.
Yeah, and we're gonna pick that conversation up because I think all the business here was disrupted. So Tom, so let's start with being a salesperson.
Yeah,
right. So I give unsolicited sales advice to people for a living, also.
Right.
So I have my little things that I tell people. But what advice would you give to somebody that is either wants to be in sales or is racking their head, be like, am I cut out for this?
You know, I think it's kind of like ties in what Joe said. You got to do what you love. And I love being around people. I love making relationships, improving relationships, staying in touch with people. I always have. And I think that's – it just kind of morphed into that. And I think as long as you're doing what you enjoy, you know, anything can work out. You know, I've heard a million people say, hey, if I do what I love, I never work a day in my life. You know, I know that's cliche, but it is really true. And so, you know, whether you're selling, you know, surgical instruments or liquor or houses, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, you need to develop relationships. And I think the advice I would give younger people is, you know, get into what you enjoy. If you're not happy, move on. You know, one of the things I was guilty about earlier in my career, I'd stay too long because I had the mentality that my father and my grandfather had, who were both in sales. You get a great job with a great company, you stay forever.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the case. No. You know, especially in today's market, and into
the ownership of companies change hands so many times
that totally
it's just impossible. That being said, look, I still look at resumes, and when I get the purple that's jumped 25 times by the time they're 35 years old, like there's red flags everywhere. And it would be very weird of me to take someone on. Like my younger brother, he's a couple years younger than me, lives in New York, has great job to great job, but he's at 8. And someone keeps hiring him.
Yeah.
It's a tech industry. It's a weird world. They tend to bounce around more. But like at some point, I'm like, dude, you realize that there's going to be a boss who, when you really want the job,
that's
why there's no freaking way I'm hiring you, right? And but that's the thing you said. Loyalty is a two-way street. I will say one of the things that I try to explain to people. So if you are selling widgets, you are transactional. And you're commoditizing. If you are selling solutions to problems, people will always come back.
True.
And in my career, my success has not been selling the assets to which this radio station has. My role has been, dude, I have a problem. I go, dude, that is not even in the realm of what I do. He goes, yeah, but you're the only guy who can fix it. Fix it. Hang up. And like, I'll go find a way to fix it. And if you are selling yourself as a problem solver versus someone selling a set widget, you will have a healthy, long career that you will probably, in most instances, undervalue what value you are to the people around you. And I think it is incredibly rewarding. And I think it is rewarding that it's almost, you don't get the recognition you deserve, but you also don't expect it.
Yeah.
Because the recognition is watching other people succeed. Right. And that, and then I'm 42 and I've been in this town for 10 years and I'm already starting to see these pieces fall into place of people that are relying on me for things so far out of my scope of work. But again, I don't complain. I just, you know what? Hey, I'll figure it out. Because that's all someone needs every time once in a while. Someone to say, I'll figure it out. And even if you're wrong, they just appreciate the fact that you tried, because most people will just give you a complete load of crap.
Yeah, as long as you're making the effort, you know, move forward, take the ball and run with it, get something done.
And be honest. You know? If you can't figure it out, say, I can't figure it out, but here's what I did to try.
This isn't going to work.
Yeah, for sure. What about, again, let's skip the whole COVID part, because this is going to be a separate conversation. What advice, now that you have your feet under you as a real estate agent, would you give to people that want to get into that industry?
I think tying into that with the sales part is, you know, years ago I was working at Coca-Cola and we had a private audience with Steve Wynn in Vegas.
Oh.
It was maybe 40 of us. And he walked in and sat there and talked to us. And one of the things he said, I'll never forget this, was, hey, listen, you know, I've been working in the casino business my whole life, but I quickly realized the only way to make money in the casino business is to own the casino. And I wish I had taken that advice 20 years ago when I heard it and went to work for myself like I do now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm my own guy. I've got people that work with me. We've got a strong team. And, you know, it's up to me to do whatever I want to do all day long. And I love it.
Yeah.
But scary.
But the same token, the 30 years of experience you had leading in puts you in a position to succeed better than it would have if you was 21.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, if you had 20 years of experience on your own, you probably would have been more successful too. So it's a catch-22. Every person's different.
But I mean, I think, you know, going to do what's going to make you happy is the main thing. And the money will come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I lived in Vegas for 7 years, which I'm sure we'll talk about in our off the air conversation. But the rumors of Steve Wynn were very true. So one of the rumors that always circled was whenever he interviewed somebody, he'd take you out to dinner.
Yeah.
And the number one trick was, if you put seasoning on your food before trying it, he would end the meeting and kick you out right there. Because the number one thing, how do you know you need salt on something that you haven't even tried?
Right.
And it circled Vegas all the time. But I had a guy who actually ran all the nightclubs for the Wynn Hotels, Surrender and all those.
Yeah.
Great guy, crazy long stories. But he was like, no, this is a very true statement. He goes, and actually at this point, he's not testing whether you have salt or pepper. It's testing if you actually heard the rumors, and if you haven't, he doesn't want you anyway.
Yeah.
Because you have no finger on the pulse whatsoever.
You
have no finger on the pulse whatsoever. So, and look, that's great. I think, you know, for me, as I think having kids has really changed a lot of perspectives.
Yeah.
I think the one thing you have to learn, at least for me, is that the first thing that you do as a manager and as a leader is think people should be like you, and there's nobody on earth that can be like you. So you have to start adjusting yourself to them. And it takes years it took me 2-3 years to figure it out. And it's hard because you want to set a level expectation. But when you start talking to people on their level and seeing their flaws and weaknesses and how you can help them, you're going to always succeed. And, you know, the best players don't always best to make coaches. The best coaches don't always make the best owners. So not every salesperson is cut out to be a manager. It's hard. And
now, and in fact, in my world, in the legal litigation world, I've given a lot of presentations over the years where I've said salespeople have generated millions in fees for me.
Yeah.
And the single biggest flaw you see is companies take their top salesperson and they want to make him the sales manager. They make he or she the sales manager when they don't want to be the sales manager. They want to be the top salesperson going on the top person sales trip, right? You've been there.
Yeah.
That's what you were just talking about.
Yep.
That's not what they want to do. It's not what they excel at. But hey, let's promote he or she to sales manager.
Yeah. It happens in the NFL. Antonio Pierce was just let go. Both players, and I'm blanking the guy's name from New England, both ex-players had 1 year of coaching and they were fired. So it doesn't always work that way.
Right.
I think one of the things about, you know, when you're a... The other part is culture, okay?
Yes.
So if you come up through an organization and you're a team member, you're exposed to culture. So you try to build in the same culture. The only way to win as a sales leader is to build your own culture.
Yes.
Because that can follow you where you go. That's where you learn. And it's a very hard thing to do. I mean, here I have a co-VP of sales, so we couldn't be more different. Now, we know the end goal, and we have gotten really good at our yin yang of how we get to the end goal. But if we had two meetings on the same topic, they would be the furthest thing from they'd be the complete opposite. It works for us.
Yes.
But at the same time, it is on a manager to build their own culture. Not an easy thing. So, all right, so let's rewind a little bit. I wanna talk COVID. Joe, let's start with you. So, the amount of money they were giving to businesses, the amount of people I know started fraudulent business just to take money, the amount of who can get fired where. I mean, the issues we had in this office, and it was just as I was being promoted to manager that I'm thrown into the fire. And
bad timing.
But look, one thing, you know, I learned is that a lot of these problems are always treated with emotion. And a lot of times you have to take emotion out of it. And you have to look at things like, here is the facts. Here are these things laid out. When you pull that emotion out of it and you look at it that way, one, it's hard because these are human beings.
Yes.
But two, you're being objective, not subjective, which is how you have to look at these things. What did you see out there?
100%. So I travel a ton for work because
there's... Do you go to Philly often?
I do go to Philly. That's the home office of our law firm.
Do you love Philly? I was just there. I was there for our Friendsgiving. I was there twice this year. My best friend lives literally next to the street Benjamin Franklin was, that old city area.
Gotcha.
And it is one of my favorite places on earth. It has a lot of the stuff that New York has, the charm, except it's like one third the price. And most places are BYOB, and you can just walk in with a jug of wine and drink all night. No one cares.
Yes. So I do enjoy going there. But in terms of my world and clients' world, so I'm traveling a ton pretty much every week, and then the world shuts down mid-March of 2020. So COVID was somewhere between 2 weeks and 2 years as you look at it, right?
Yep.
And so—
We're in Atlanta, so 3.5 weeks.
But again, if you look at it from being in Philly or being in New York the impact of COVID versus Atlanta, or talk to clients and friends who are in San Francisco,
completely
they're looking at us like, you guys are in denial.
Yeah.
We can't even go out of our house. We can't do anything.
So a quick story on that. My father was the CEO of Elmhurst Hospital. He retired at 59 and a half. Wasn't supposed to, woke up at 59 and a half. He's like, done. Called in, retired on the spot. But when you saw the ice trucks packing bodies in it, when they was on the all over the TV, that was my dad's hospital.
Oh my gosh.
So they pretty much, he was out and completely done. And they're like, you have to get back here. I don't care. You have to get back here.
Yeah, because they were using the Javits Center.
It was Elmhurst Hospital. Now, Elmhurst Hospital happens to be the location in New York with the most undocumented immigrants. It's the most densely populated part of Queens, and it has the only helipad in the area because it's not in Manhattan. So it was just a cluster, but I literally saw it on the TV, and I was like, oh, my God. I mean, just to see what my father had to deal with his whole life. But anyway, yes, it was treated very differently up there than it was here.
So treated differently. So And it's a good thing you said of objectivity versus subjectivity. So a lot of companies went from going gangbusters to their business is shut down.
Yeah.
So they have to let a third of their company go or 60% of the company go. And so what that did is it brought all sorts of employment claims. And then you had COVID claims. And you had, you know, the business-related claims. And so to your point of people calling and asking questions of, that had never come up before, we'll figure it out.
And there was no precedent.
We'll figure it out.
Law works on precedent, right?
Yes, we can help you with that. It had never been, and hopefully it'll never happen again.
Yeah. But at the same time, you're single-handedly responsible to some extent for setting new precedent, right?
Yes.
Because these are new things. And when you establish precedent in law, that's what the next cases are based on. They look back to these precedent cases.
And so it wasn't just litigation. Like you, we were talking about the liquor business. A dear friend, the guy that got me the website, justapoorcountrylawyer.com, is in the events business in San Francisco. And his company, Wine Meets Cheese, they pivoted overnight because they went from fully booked to zero events. Okay, how's he going to make money? Online calls. Hey, Joe, can we ship here? Can we do this?
Yeah.
Don't worry. We'll find you the right people to figure it out.
Yeah.
So you had to pivot. You had to figure out.
And that's where being small and dynamic was better, nimble. The big companies were never going to figure it out. The bureaucracy is too great. Those small companies. You know, one of the things that happened here, there were no sports and there was nobody in cars. We are sports radio. So what the hell are we going to do? But we came into work every day. And I think it was about... You know, let's say it started in March. We had just found out March Madness wasn't going to be here.
Yep.
All the seasons were canceled. It was a kick right in the cojones to have this all happen. But we looked and we said, you know what? What did we do wrong? And we have no digital infrastructure. Everyone's now relying on this digital. We don't have it. So we looked and we started. I think it was about May after I got over the fact that my wife was telling me I was crazy for coming into work every day. But I was like, first of all, there's nobody in the battery. This is probably the safest place I could be. There's nobody here.
Right.
So I came in here every day and it was about April. I go, you know what? The work that I put in over the next year and a half, however long this is, will dictate the rest of my career because I figured so much stuff out. And the reason was all these people from these companies weren't working with clients. Right. I had their sole attention. People that used to work with 200 people at the same time were only working with me because nobody else was working.
Right.
So I got their full attention. So we retrofitted this company. We have so much infrastructure that we would have never had with COVID. But I see the other side of it. I see the fear. Now, ironically, all my family in New York tell me I'm crazy for coming into work every day. Guess where I get COVID? From my sister-in-law attorney in New York.
There you go.
Is the one who gave me over dinner, the one who was like, you, I can't believe you're putting everybody at risk. Fly up. She's the one who gives me COVID. Of course how it works. And look, I think, again, precedent is important here, but it's also a lot of times people just need a shoulder to cry on and they just want to get it off their chest. How do you handle that? How do you handle because again, a lawyer to some extent, all these jobs have blurred. Cops have become psychologists.
Yeah. Yep.
They've all blurred and the expectations we have of people are not based on the job descriptions or reality. How do you handle the people that are coming in that you just want the shoulder to cry and it's just someone to hear them versus what's a real case and what's something that you can actually litigate?
Well, and mine is all 99% on the defense standpoint. So companies are getting sued unless, you know, it's a non-compete case where we're the plaintiff. But by and large, you know, where I have that phenomenon to where you're talking about is where an HR person, human resources at a company, or a manager who's getting accused of whatever, they're venting to me about being involved in this case. How do I get involved in this? How am I going to tell my wife? How is this going to work out? Where the line is blurred from, am I giving legal advice here to where
it's a shrink?
Am I Dr. Phil? Because, you know, I'm not really good at being Dr. Phil, so I'll steal his line and go, well, how's that working out for you?
So, and lawyers get paid a higher hourly rate. So,
and then the other reason, you said that is the way to cut some of those off. Is you know we're billing you for this, so then they get really quiet.
Just start billing by the minute. It's not even the hour anymore. You know what? We're going to switch to by the minute. We need to wrap this up. Speaking of wrapping it up, holy crap, we went really long on this segment. We're going to come back, Dom, and then we're going to go to you because I want to talk. Booze is the one that's most interesting to me. I do want to briefly talk about Coca-Cola because the legacy that they have formed in the employees leaving has been amazing.
Yeah.
My experience with the Coca-Cola employees hasn't been the same with the people that left. Some of them, I think, were riding the coattails in the 70s and 80s too hard, and they think that they're God's gift and they have no actual skill sets whatsoever. But anyway, that's a good way to end this segment. So you've been listening to the Market Minute Mad Men on Extra 106.3, and we'll be right back.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. Nick Constantino here with Joe Chucci and Tom McCorkle. And Tom, talk a little bit. We're going to do this in a couple of spurts, okay? Obviously, real estate, just interest rates going up. It was a crazy time, right?
Yeah.
Let's get this one out of the way. So I got lucky. Everyone told me don't buy during COVID. And I was like, cool. So I bought during COVID at a 2.6% interest rate. I bought a house in by Northlake that was 500 grand. That's doubled in value in 4 years. Like, so they were all wrong, as people usually are.
True.
But talk about the disruption and talk about, because one of the things I found, like mortgage companies, they were all raking in the dough. And instead of putting that money away to average when times are slow, they all just declare bankruptcy. Real estate agents, everyone entered the field. Now they're all dying and wondering why. Talk about what you're seeing out there now with the interest rates being so high and how that's coming off of COVID.
You know, the rates are, they're adjusting every day. And I think the thing I tell all my clients, and I think most realtors do as well or should, is the time to buy is when you find the home you want.
Yeah.
You know, the rates are going to come and go. You can always refinance. We're not going to see the rates in the twos again. So good for you for not listening to everybody during COVID and buy-in, because that 2-point rate is not going to come around again.
Yeah. Unless that's also why nobody's selling.
Exactly.
Because everyone's locked into these low rates, so the chance of them selling,
yeah,
of you finding your dream house has gone down too, and so you have to move that much quicker.
You can sell and move into something smaller, but you can be paying the same amount of price. You know, right. Monthly mortgage is going to be the same because of interest rates. So we watch them closely, but at the same time, it's kind of like watching the stock market. I don't live and die by watching what the market's
going to
do.
You're not going to time either. If you think you're going to rent for a little while and buy when it's high, you have no idea.
No.
Human nature and psychology of people is so screwed up. Everyone that's tried to make a prediction, they all tout about, oh my God, look at that. I made the prediction.
Yeah.
But no one talks about how much they fail. Just like I always win at the casino because I only tell people when I win. I never tell people when I lose.
The house always wins.
The house always wins. They're smarter than you, I promise.
They are.
And it's an interesting one. I'm more concerned and to talk about one. Talk about Coke a little bit.
Yeah.
Talk about just why they are so renowned. I mean, obviously, we're going to look back, and it's the word is starting to come out now. I see all these comparisons on social media, like can of beer, can of Coke. Why is this one being put a government warning that says it's going to cause cancer when you look at this one, right? Six cans of Coke a day is going to kill you way before six cans of beer are going to. You're not on their payroll anymore, right?
I haven't been for a long, long time.
As long as I'm not hearing you,
they're not going to come after me.
How was it the company mystique? Was it their training? Was the instructor? Why is it so synonymous with success in business?
You know, I think, you know, that goes back way, way long ago from the history of the company and the success it has as a brand. You know, the brand Coca-Cola is global, and it always has been. And, you know, I grew up in a time when, you know, Diet Coke wasn't a big thing. You know, everybody drank Coke, and it was just a thing. And growing up in the South, you know, it doesn't matter what soft drink you're drinking, do you want a Coke?
Yeah.
So, you know, when I got that job,
Cheerwine, right?
And, you know, exactly. So, you know, the thing is, I was just so proud to work for the company.
Yeah.
And things changed. Roberto Goizueta, who was a longtime CEO, super successful,
yeah,
passed away during I was there.
After, they named the school after
the business
Emory.
School at Emory, right. And that was, you talked about culture earlier, and he had created a phenomenal culture at the company. And so everybody was proud to work there. Everything was, you know, clicking along great. And then, you know, he passed away and things changed. You know, they had a lot of different CEOs during my tenure.
I have to imagine that was also, he went over when we went international with everything. The company was booming and growing in every direction. So it's easy to lead with culture when you're growing at a 30% clip every year.
Absolutely.
The market stagnated. It's not a growth industry anymore. So I have to imagine that changed a little bit. But yeah, culture. I mean, it's that important. That's why his name's on a building.
Yeah, and it's true with any kind of industry or any kind of marketing company. And I think that's where Coke really excels, even to this day, is their marketing company.
Yeah.
You know, because they've got so many different brands, yeah. so many different SKUs.
Yeah.
And you know, they got into the water business a little bit late.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, has boomed, and the energy drinks, and so they've done a great job of that. And with me, I was there, you know, it's been a long, long time since I was there. Yeah. I left and went in the liquor business. Yeah. I left Coke to go to work for Jim Beam.
Yeah.
And talk about a change of direction.
All right. Wow. So we're going to skip what you're saying, because I'm going to tell you my beef with Jim Beam, because Jim Beam is an active client of ours. I love them. Chrissy, I love you. Darian, I love you. They have reorganized their company in the past 7 years, 7 times. Every time I'm on the phone with somebody, they're going through a reorganization. Now, Suntory bought them. Then they dropped the name Beam, and it's Suntory. And they are sitting on stockpiles of so much booze that they can single-handedly influence this industry if they wanted to. But they're more worried with the bureaucracy and the restructuring and the corporate. So when you were there, talk about when you were there, but talk about the liquor industry as a whole and how COVID, what happened during COVID.
I mean, this is so long before COVID when I was there. And they had recruited me for a long time because I was on the board of a big group called the Nightclub and Bar Show, which is a big show, the beverage show in Vegas, adult beverage show.
Yes.
And I was the Coke representative there. And the VP at Beam kept recruiting me and kept offering me a job, but he was offering me a lot less than I was making at Coke. I'm like, I can't take a haircut, you know? Well, time came. I was like, you know, I'm really interested now, so I'll take that role. And it was great. I just loved it because, I mean, it was just a completely different dynamic, completely different culture.
Yeah. When was this?
I would say 93, 94.
Okay, so this is before the bourbon boom. So
yes,
it was
absolutely.
Beam. It was Beam Black. They probably had Booker's and a couple of the Basil Hayden was the most popular, probably craft one there was.
But you're right. The boom on single malts and for the Scotch business and for bourbons hadn't happened yet. What had happened then and started to explode was vodka.
Yeah.
Because the Sex and the City came out not long after that. Yeah. And the martinis and Coke, or excuse me, Absolute.
And there's also no barriers to entry. It's the easiest thing in the world to make. You don't need to age it. You just freaking throw it in a still
water,
and you add vodka.
You know?
Potatoes. Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, I left Beam to go to work for Absolute.
Got it.
And Absolute had come out with Absolute Citron, which was the first big flavor.
Was it already Pernod? Was it already owned by Pernod?
It was Pernod Ricard. Yeah. Very good. And so... was there 7 years. My entire career.
Absolute was a marketing company.
Oh, absolutely.
If you were ever a Maxim guy, I mean, those freaking, when you had those bottles with the cutouts of things inside them, they were some of the best ads I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So simple, but they elicited a response. And that's, you know what? It's a good point to talk about it.
Yeah.
One of the things that really frustrates me about marketing these days, we're so reliant on data.
Yeah.
Data can never show an emotional connection. And I was underage, right? I was, I was drinking since I was 14, but we'll save that point. But when I looked at the Absolute ad, I'm like, holy crap, I think I'm going to go buy Absolute. That looks like what I want to do. I want to drink and have all these pretty women around me in a freaking circus safari in neon green. This is what I want.
People used to keep the empty bottles in college.
I did it. I have a glow light. But that has been removed from it now. It's not about emotional connections. It's about data points. And you cannot, and Coca-Cola, you don't see Coca-Cola. We have 64 data points to show this. They show images of things that you love. And I think that's what's been taken away from marketing.
Mm-hmm. But it has been. It definitely has been.
So, So you did Absolute. Where else? Anywhere else? Steady stops along the way in the liquor?
Yeah, I mean, it was like 20 some odd years. So, you know, 3 or 4 years with Beam, and then left. It went to Pernod Ricard.
Yep.
Which had, you know, our big brands were Absolute, Jameson.
Yep.
I spent a ton, and the whole time I basically had the same job. I was a national account director who managed hotel and casinos.
Sure.
So I traveled a ton, did a lot of trips to Europe, met a lot of great people, a lot of fun people, a lot of interesting people.
That's what we're gonna have. That'll be the offline conversation.
And then left there for my last 7 years in the business. I was with a family owned company out of Scotland called William Grant and Sons.
Okay.
Their biggest brand is Hendrick's Gin.
Yeah.
Another marketing coup.
I mean, again, I'm in this industry because of what I do.
But, yeah.
And I know the distributors and everything. And I think the one thing about alcohol during COVID, everyone thought, the fear was everyone was going to trade down.
Yeah.
Okay. Because stock market's crashing. But what they found out was, holy crap, that $16 drink in a bar, I can buy a bottle for $25. What are we doing here? And they traded up. And then all of a sudden, this huge wave of these allocated brands and all this stuff swept everything. Well, because these companies take so long to react, now they're going to have to dig themselves out of their delay for 2 years. Because now all the allocated stuff is just sitting on shelves because no one's going to pay $150 for a bottle. I'm hearing that the wine companies have cellars full of wine. It's funny. You always see it. We tend to, as a country, make the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah.
And every time we think, we're over that, then all of a sudden something happens and it's like, nope, we're making the same mistakes. We're overspending. Household debt has blown up. You know, what we need to do is open up these allocated bottles and start putting them to market. But instead, we triple the price because we don't want the markup. Now no one's buying them on the aftermarket. So it's a crazy world. But I'm glad we got that all out of the way. We're about to shut off the radio show. Thank you for listening on Extra 106.3. I encourage everybody to check out the podcast because we're going to have some real fun with it. You've been listening to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3, and we'll catch you next week. So we are back. We are on podcast-only version. This is Marketing Madman After Dark. We got Joe Chuchi here, and we got Tom McCorkle. So, Joe, I'm going to go back to you. So you've been with bands. You've traveled with bands. I will start with my crazy story. I'm not going to name the artist. Yep. Actually, I'll tell two crazy stories real quick. One was, and I will say the artist, God bless him, but I don't think it's going to surprise anybody. One was I was working in a venue, and as a director of sponsorship, I was one of three people that was allowed to be around for soundcheck, right? You don't want to be around for soundcheck. Yep. And this is just as the Live Nation wave of they're starting to really manipulate music.
Yep.
And I'm walking around, I'm going, and I hear a sound coming from the speakers that could only be akin to a dying giraffe. Like, and I am like, what the hell is going on? And actually, in fact, it was Ozzy Osbourne. He couldn't even sing anymore. He couldn't even get the muster, the words out. Right. And it is like an animal dying. And then sure enough, concert starts. They flip on the post-processing and it sounds like Ozzy Osbourne.
Right.
So it was depressing, but at the same time, it was my first glimpse into, you know, how this really works. The second one was, I won't name the artist. I can name the artist. No, it's not going to surprise anyone anyway. But this said artist still had Jack Daniels, cocaine, and hookers on his rider. And because he had been grandfather clause into the venue from the 70s and 80s when these things were just part of business, like, we had to adhere to the rider.
Sure.
So in the rider, and I go back, I go backstage after every show. It is not somebody I particularly liked because it was just not my kind of music. I thought he was a little scammy, but I grew to like him. And I was backstage and I go, oh my God. And it was, first of all, he was the nicest human being alive. He was like the coolest dude I'd ever been around. And it was another one of the reality of it. I'd done a lot of shows in Vegas where I'd have artists come and we'd be at tables together and all that stuff. But they were the new wave of artists, right? They weren't the guys who were behaving like Motley Crue. And that's such a stark difference. So, you know, you go into as much detail as you want. You can say fuck as many times as you want. We're off air now. So talk a little bit about just the crazy things you've seen, how the generations have changed of music. What's wrong with music now? We're open for them, brother. Hit it.
Wow, that's a wide open one.
Yeah.
So, you know, Tom and I go and visit Bunny Carlos of Cheap Trick. And Bunny is telling us some of their legendary stories. Yeah. You know, they blew up, I want to say it's 5 years ago, but it wasn't. Live at Budokan. You know, where they just exploded and they couldn't even go outside. And so then you fast forward to 2 months ago where guys in the Zac Brown Band are telling me what their riders were when, you know, down the road at the Dixie Tavern to, you know, bring in bottles of Jägermeister on stage. And, you know, the unmistakable sound of ch-ch-ch-ch, you know, the Jäger bottle thing inside that, you know, to this day, I can't drink Jägermeister. And so these guys have gone from bringing bottles of Jaeger on stage to where they don't drink until after the show.
You almost can't.
To where they're like,
you almost can't. I went to go see.
You're gonna die. You think you're gonna be Motley Crue, but you're not.
I went to go see Green Day at Truist Park, right? And I was iffy. Like, I saw the Pumpkins. I love Smashing Pumpkins. It was amazing. Okay, and I love Green Day individually, but for whatever reason, the music doesn't hold up as well as I wanted it to.
Right.
Okay? Leave it at that. That dude came out.
Yep.
And was like an Olympic athlete.
Yes.
He was flying around the stage.
Yes.
It hit every note. And apparently, from what I hear, they train for 6 months to do these shows.
Yes.
They eat clean. They have dietitians.
Yeah.
It has become such a different part of it. But it has to be, because to pay the ticket prices, people are expecting a flawless show. They're not expecting Janis Joplin to miss a note and fall off the stage, or, you know, Santana to have an LSD badge in his thing at Woodstock.
Right.
That's not what they want anymore.
No, they going full bore. Trey Cool's going. They'll lose 30, 40 pounds and get in shape.
And for me, it frustrates me,
right?
Because I feel like I'm being served a fake product. Like, if I want that crap, I'll buy the record, right? Like, we know it's fake on the record. I want the flawed music. I want the parts. I don't need a guy dancing. I'm not at a freaking ballet. I want people that play rock and roll. So anyway, I don't know what the hell we were talking about. I just went on a tangent there, but
riders,
how in shape they are. Yes,
yeah, like, I mean, but again, the riders, you know, some of it they do is a joke, but When they talk about drinking and doing some of those things for the tours that they have, that you just can't, because they're not kids anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll tell you privately they just can't sustain it. Again, you switch gears from rock and roll, Jason Aldean. Those guys will have a drink in that band and stuff, but it's like, okay. But you talk to Rich the drummer, he works out nonstop.
Yeah.
Because they're doing it for 2 hours.
Yeah, but again, as a drummer, you can't. You're putting the metronome for the whole band. If you miss a note, you can throw everything off.
They all know. And again, the drummer that I miss more than anybody, I'm a huge fan of Taylor Hawkins. And again, that's, you know, the downside of that, how he passed away.
Yeah.
Just terrible issues.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was, you didn't know, just reading interviews and watching these things. Absolutely one of my favorite drummers. His was anxiety.
Yeah.
Huge. I mean, you would think that a guy like that was completely at home, scared to death of being on stage.
Yeah.
And he was that good.
And those are the things the alcohol doesn't help. So they're starting to find out now how dopamine and serotonin work, and the alcohol floods your brain with dopamine but never hits you with the serotonin. So you're always feeling anxious without feeling the relief.
Correct.
And that's what they prey on, by the way. Casinos, alcohol, all these industries.
Yep.
We've learned so much about the brain now that what we're trying to do is create this dopamine drip that never has the serotonin end. So you're always just wanting the next thing.
Well, that's why the casinos are pumping oxygen in.
Oh, I know that. I
took and have no windows.
I took so many psychology of gambling courses in Vegas. It turned me into a pretty good gambler, because like when I'm sober, put it this way, when you're sober, you're never going to win, but it's easier to not lose when you're making educated, smart things. It's when you're hammered and you're chasing your bets, which literally there's big signs at the casino say they don't chase bets, but you're still, it's amazing. All right, Tom. So you traveled obviously all over the world. Alcohol, the industry itself is leading it. Talk about some crazy things you saw. Talk about Europe. I'm heading to London in a couple of weeks. I've been, but I'm going back, and this time with my wife, not crazy study abroad, but talk a little bit about some of the things you saw, some of the crazy things that you just, situations you were thrown in.
You know, one of the best things in that job is we would entertain our clients and take them to the distilleries.
Yeah.
So you would tour the distilleries and you would go and spend the night. Perrier-Jouët is a very famous champagne in Epernay, France, and we would spend the night in the castle there and tour and go underneath, do stuff we're not supposed to do at night.
Yeah.
One time we were at the Balvenie House in Scotland.
Gotcha.
And I had some clients who were overserved.
I'm glad you told me how to say it. I was like Balvenie this whole time. Balvenie. Yeah. And now Balvenie. I know. That's like with watches. Every time I say something, my owner's like, that's not how you say it. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not, I can't speak Swiss French. I'm sorry.
No, and it's fine. Yeah. We found out later in the evening, because we've been drinking scotch all night long, expensive scotch, that a couple of guys got out in the middle of the night and went into the Barley House and were doing Snow Angels in the Barley House. And the malt master came in the next morning. He's like, Tom, what the fuck? He goes, what are these guys doing? He goes, I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, come here. And I went in there, and there's Snow Angels out in the they were hammered.
And now, to be fair, because I've had this experience.
Is that wrong?
Yeah. I've had this experience at, I think it was Buffalo Trace, but I got a private tour, and they actually allow you to put your hands in the wort and eat it out, because it's going to distill and kill anything that's in there anyway. So they could probably still use that malt.
They did. It wasn't a big deal.
The wort, this is my understanding. I have a very rudimentary understanding, but the wort is almost beer that they distill to become the thing. And because it's going through this process, the alcohol, doesn't matter what's in it, it'll become, it's like rubbing alcohol. It will be disappeared.
That's
so
true.
They let you just put your hand in, and it's disgusting.
Smell it?
It's not something you want to taste.
No.
But I was like, fuck it. Ugh. So, and look, I think those brands, I think that one of the things I really see happening is the tradition and heritage is going to make a comeback.
Yes.
Right? We've been so worried about the influencer and the hot thing. Screw that stuff, man. The French... Look, geopolitically, there's so many things that they don't know how the hell to do it, but they know how to make wine and cheese, dude, really, really well. Spain, Italy,
yes,
why
do.
Are we trying to rewrite all this stuff? If you actually go back to these heritage brands and this heritage tradition, there is so much to be found there. Freaking music. You know, one of the problems with current music is they hit a 128 beat metronome and everyone's on the same thing because it's how
formula.
Your brain's wired.
Yep.
What I think music will go back to it. I think these big festivals are done. I think people are going to want to see an intimate thing with a guy with a guitar on stage.
Yes.
And it's going to become small and more intimate, where you see the flaws. Why does everything have to be perfect?
Yes.
There's something to be said about, you know, you go to a band and a band that can take a song, you know, and it's funny because I say that and there's sometimes people do it and piss me off. Yeah. I saw Chili Peppers twice and they went too long on soloing their songs when they have 50 hits. I'm like, dude, just play.
Right.
Go an extra minute or two, but don't do a 14-minute long rendition of Under the Bridge. I don't need to hear it. But anyway, I think we're going to go back to more authentic. I think food, I think people are done. Farm to table, but organic, who cares? Make food the way they used to make it in fire and see everything happening. And I hope that we go back to it. I don't think that's conservatism. I just think that's more, that's how I grew up. My parents were immigrants.
Yep.
I grew up around all these international things, and we've gotten too, by being fancy, we've actually almost gotten bland.
Yeah, I would agree, whether it's music or food, the things, you know, my wife and I were talking about this, it's becoming simpler. Don't want to go to a huge concert. Again, I could have gone to the Chili Peppers in their town. I gave the tickets away. And it was more meaningful to go a smaller show. Love the Zac Brown Band. Went to a party recently, and Clay Cook, the guitarist, he literally was playing a mediocre guitar.
Yeah.
But it was amazing.
Yeah.
With Danny, the percussionist, playing a little cajon.
Yeah, that being said.
And again, they'd start it, and it was like, okay, it's out of tune, and it, you know.
Not everybody gets access. When you have access, one of the things I got to do in Vegas was Perry Farrell's 50th birthday party.
Yeah.
It went to a topless pool. They put glass over the pool, and he just put a stage up.
Yeah.
Okay? So I saw literally, and I don't remember how I was invited. I was so involved in the industry, but I pretty much saw I forget the lady's name from Blondie. She was singing Call Me with Tom Morello playing a guitar with his teeth.
Deborah Harry.
And Tom Morello was playing guitar with his teeth.
Yeah,
and like really? That was what was happening on stage. And you see, and Perry Farrell's playing the drums and everyone's dancing around. Yeah. And you're like, this is what, and you're not going to see that all the time, but it has been stripped out of it because we've allowed capitalism and corporations, Live Nation, to take everything about. You got every tour has to fit into a certain box. You have to be on the stage. The lighting has to match to save money. So you can literally be like, all right, I'm going to see this set list from last night. It's the same set list. They do two different encores and it just changes. It's such a shame.
Yeah.
It's such a shame. Tom, so all the experiences you've had, but the liquor industry is going to change. People's habits have changed.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's starting to be spoken about, I think when people realize that you can drink a THC drink with 5 milligrams of THC, one with 0 calories, to get the same chilling effect that 3 glasses of wine and 400 calories do, I think it's going to come into the limelight. And I think like anything, look, the alcohol industry makes its most money on the addicts. Let's call it what it is. You always make your most money in every industry on the one percenters, the people who consume the most. But I think that the health and the habits, and it's finally starting to resonate with people's heads. I mean, guys, I haven't had a drink since New Year's Day, okay? So it's been a couple of days. I feel like as sharp as I've ever felt in my entire life. And I will do this for 6-7 weeks straight. I cut coffee out, other things, but it's getting very hard.
You cut out alcohol and coffee.
Yeah, and I'm Italian. And I used to drink 3-4 cups a day. I went cold turkey.
It's like we don't even know you.
I don't know myself sometimes. But
you're not Scandinavian?
Life is very short, and I'm going to London for Valentine's Day. And like when I land in London, the alcohol will be that much better.
Like
and the coffee
shot
will be
out of
that
a can.
Much better. Yeah. And
I'll have some suggestions for you when you go to London. We were talking about the Balvenie. We were hosting a show over there. We used to do a show for the Balvenie. And the time, the host was Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
And so we got to meet him, and then we started doing events with him.
What was he like? Because I've heard so many stories that he was – and the word wasn't too smart for his own good, like almost too clever for his own good. He was in his head. And it was just what was the experience like? Did it feel like he was doing something for money, or was he just kind of hanging out?
No, I got the feeling, and I did a dozen or so events with him and got to go to his house in New York.
Cool.
We did a couple events up there in New York, a couple private parties. We were on a plane one time down to Fort Lauderdale, and he found out I lived in Chicago for a while. And we talked about pizza. You know, and he said, oh my God, that deep dish stuff is an abomination.
It's an abomination.
Because it's just...
The amount of butter, if you've ever seen it made, the way it cooks together. I mean, I get it. Like every once in a while, I will feed a good Chicago, but I can have a slice and then I want something
that's
real.
That's fine. It's a casserole. I mean,
I can't wait to get a nice slice of pizza tomorrow when I go to New York.
New York, I got to have that. That's what we were talking about, the differences in that. But he was just laid back. He was funny. I got to meet his good friend Eric Repair because he's got his restaurant in New York.
Lumberton.
Yeah. And so we got to spend a lot of time with him on those kinds of things because of the working relationship.
Yeah.
And he was what you saw on TV to me. He was a fun, laid back guy. He didn't like a whole lot of people around.
Yeah.
But, you know, because I was with the company that was paying him,
yeah,
we spent a lot of time and got to know each other, and that was fun. Yeah. So it was a very unfortunate thing when he passed.
Yeah.
But he liked to have a good time.
Yeah, I mean, look, it tends to be the best people at what they do, especially in TV and music, are the ones that die, right? Like, you know, losing Cornell and Weiland and Chester Bennington from Linkin Park, that was my generation.
Oh, yeah.
I was losing Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison. Like, if you go back and listen, and like, there's a reason you can hear the pain in people's voices, and that's what makes them great musicians, right?
They've lived it.
I love the party guys, all that stuff. They will never last as long as the Nirvanas and the guys who died, because the pain and they lose themselves in the music, because that's how they cope with the craziness that's going on in their head. I was going to say one thing. I don't remember where I read it, but I think one of the things that this world nowadays is lacking is nuance. We have lost the nuance in everything. Everything is so quick and we're moving and everything. We've lost the nuance. And one of the things that I loved about Bourdain was there was nuance to everything, right? It wasn't, I love this. It's, I love this because of this. And it makes you think about things differently. One of the things I like about really good old classic rock is the pace switched. There was nuance to everything. I just feel like what we're doing in this world now, we lack nuance with everything.
Right. So what you talked about earlier of everything at 128 beats per minute, okay? People always talk about John Bonham as a drummer.
Yep.
Okay. But if you listen, There's guys that do this on different things. The tempo fluctuates on some of these things, like Fool in the Rain and some of these just iconic drum beats. They fluctuate.
Yeah.
So if you put them on a music grid,
of course,
and I've seen people do it, and they line them up, make it perfect, it sounds awful because it doesn't have that human element.
Yeah.
Like even some of those songs that, you know, those original recordings, you can hear his kick pedal squeaking.
Yeah.
They didn't fix it.
Yeah.
They didn't fix the tempo.
But it's funny.
But it's organic, and it's awesome.
It's too homogenized.
When rock and roll came out of really rhythm and blues that had jazz influence in it. And if you ever listen to jazz, I mean, look, I'm not talking Coltrane, I'm talking Mingus. It is a wreck. If you ever tried to plot out Thelonious Monk or Mingus,
it's a train wreck.
It's a train wreck.
Yes.
But when you listen to it, it's unbelievably pleasing. So rock didn't come out of homogenized stuff. It came out of, and look, the earliest things were very BPM, Chuck Berry, they're very BPM driven.
Yes.
But when you talk about the greatest songs, and I'm always a pace guy. I love songs that change pace.
Yes.
Right? Even Elton John, Funeral for a Friend, like just songs that are ballady but change pace so many times.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I like. That's not easy for a drummer to do because you're changing the whole metronome of the music. Do they do that very much anymore? I don't hear it very often.
You know, I mean, look, the ones that you listen to, I mean, some of the last Foo Fighters stuff, the Red Hot Chili Peppers will do it, some of those things, but not a ton. You know, they all...
They want to follow that formula.
No offense to radio. The rock radio, country radio want a 3.5-minute song that is on a click track, on a grid.
It's a damn shame. But that being said, everything goes in cycles.
Yes.
We will cycle away from it. The concept of a pop star will change. Like, we're going to bring some more soul back. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I've been doing a lot of history of this country studying and pop culture and money and everything. And every time it has changed so much. And you see the changes happening. I think what happened was COVID should have been the change because we couldn't do these things, but we built out so much pent-up demand that we're still riding the coattails of pent-up demand.
Right?
You see it. Taylor Swift, I mean, she sold out billions, but she couldn't tour for 3 years. So a lot of that is built-up stuff. What you're seeing now is the biggest, best getting all the attention and the smaller stuff, and that's because everyone wants to post on social media they were there,
right?
Which is freaking pathetic. If you're going to a show because you think you have to, your friends care, that's the opposite of what music does, but it's unfortunate truth.
Well, that always strikes my wife and I as just it just makes me go crazy. Is, you know, we're fortunate enough, we're close to the stage, and you see a young man or a young woman in the first row or second row, and Taylor Swift or Justin Timberlake or somebody, and they're right there, and rather than looking 2 feet away, connecting, they turn around to do a video selfie.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally turn their back on the artist, and you can just see, you just want to go, whap, hit them right in the back of the head. Like, dude, they're right there.
You could
fist bump them, and you turned around.
And you'll never look at those pictures.
No. Well, they never look right.
Chance. You have a million pictures. Like, I still go back and I had like a Polaroid and I look at like pictures of Polaroid because it's in a book because you only have 20. Right. You have to take good ones.
Yes.
It's such a shame. All right, gentlemen, this has been great. We're going to end with this, okay? We're going to go industry specific. So, Tom, I want you to think about the best drink you've ever had, where it was and what it was. And Joe, I want you to think about the best show you've ever saw and why. Okay.
Yeah.
And we're in the podcast, so you guys can take a second.
Okay.
We can pause this one here.
Best show.
Yeah, but we can pause this one here.
Okay.
I will. You know what? I will start with a recent best show, and it follows. So, I used to work. I worked for Live Nation for 2 years, so my job was to be at shows. So I was everywhere.
Yeah.
I used to go to Hangout Fest every year, Bonnaroo. I was at the Woodstock in '99. I was 16 years old. And my parents letting me go to that. I've seen a lot of music. But the best recent thing, you talk about cell phone, was we have our concert club seats at State Farm, which are literally in this raised club and the speaker is pretty much hitting you in the face.
Yep.
Love it.
And I wanted to go see Tool at State Farm.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Okay, so first thing is, and I've seen him before, is Maynard is a maniac. He hides behind a curtain because he hates being in front of people.
Yep.
But they come on, he goes, all right, he goes, everyone, he goes, do me one favor. And he goes, it's not a favor because I will kick you out of here. Phone's in your pocket. If you take out a phone, take a camera, I have bodyguards everywhere, you're out.
Yep.
So nobody had their phones. And he goes, we're going on a journey. All I want you to do is give me 2 hours of your attention. If that's 2 hours, get the fuck out of here.
Yep.
Okay, so everyone is just enthralled in it. They are literally fish with electric guitars. It's a jam band.
Yeah.
There's no method to the music.
Nope.
They are just playing face melting. It goes from like melodic to just, and I sat, I won't say what I did to get myself my mind right for it, but you know, we had some extracurriculars to make my mind right. But yep. Holy crap, did I enjoy that 2 hours of not having anything to look at but stare at a speaker. I'm probably still half deaf, that's why I'm yelling.
Yep.
But it's not my favorite meet by any means, but it was such a reminder of what music should be.
Yep.
And it's a shame because it was all 50-year-olds that were there.
Yeah.
Right. There were no kids there. That's what the kids needed to see. Right. So anyway. So hopefully that gets your brains going. So Tom, why don't you go first? What about just a drink, really memorable drink, where and what it was?
I've got the drink, but before I do that, I want to tell you a quick rock and roll story as far as shows. And it wasn't one, it was four in a row. And I'd call it the best 4 days of my music audience career.
Yeah.
And a buddy of mine, Lou, who was a VP at Marriott at the time, we did a lot of shows together. He said, look, I got tickets for Jay Giles Band in D.C. Once you come up on a Thursday night, no problem, I'll be there. Well, the Wednesday night before, right here down the street over at Cumberland, whatever the venue is over here now.
Yeah, Cobb Galleria.
Yeah, Cobb Galleria. My son at the time was a huge fan of the Wiggles, which is the band from...
I know the Wiggles, Australia.
I haven't been to a Wiggles concert.
My son is three. I'm very wiggly.
There you go. Well, we got to go...
As wholesome, by the way, these you can't even trust these guidelines. What they say is TV appropriate. The Wiggles are one of the more wholesome things. Besides
hot
the
potato,
sexual
attention,
besides the sexual attention between the yellow one and the purple one who are married, besides the blatant sexual attention on television.
You get it.
Go on.
So we went. So I said, look, my son Jay, I told him, I'm taking you to the show. And we knew somebody working there. And right in the middle of the show at the time, Murray, the guy in the red guitar, comes up behind us and starts talking to us. And my son, it was to see how excited he was. He was probably six at the time. It was just fantastic. So I'm like, okay, this is the start of my rock and roll tour. So we did that. The next day, I'm up in D.C. with my buddy Lou. We go see Jay Giles Band in some small dive bar. Next night's a Friday.
9:30 Club, I would bet.
I think that was it.
9:30 Club.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I lived in D.C.
for
7 years.
So we take the train up to Philly the next day to go see my first U2 show.
Cool.
And it was at the stadium, and it was just amazing. And then the next night, I'm taking Lou to Yankee Stadium to see Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Wow.
And at the time, I'm working for Absolute Vodka. And I'm a Beatles freak.
Yeah.
It's an understatement, as Joe knows. So anyway, we go up there, and he calls me and goes, dude, my wife's going to kill me. I can't do three shows in a row. I said, well, what am I going to do? So I get up there, and I call my assistant at the time, and she said, look, the president of Live Nation at the time, I don't know if you knew Brian Yost, was a friend of mine because he had worked at Marriott. Yeah. He was the head of beverage at Marriott for years. I'd called him. I said, Brian, if you have any tickets, I'm going to be in New York City. I've got some okay tickets, and didn't hear from him. He's a CEO. He didn't have time to call me back. So she calls me and says, there's some tickets here. I said, I'm on the train. I'm going to Bronx to Yankee Stadium. She's like, I think you need to come back. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I go, she goes, you think I should just go? And she goes, listen, it's the CEO. You think these tickets are any good? Get your ass back here.
Yeah.
So I go pick them up and I walk in. I'm by myself.
Awesome. Those are always the best. Those are always the best, by the way.
Yeah.
When you end up out by yourself in the world. Woo.
First time, I'd never even seen the Yankees play there before. I have now. But so I walk in, and every time I get to an usher, they're like, you're down there. You're down there. I'm on the front row, Paul McCartney, right smack in the middle.
Wow.
And so those were my best 4 days in a row of music.
Cool.
So it was jamming.
I'm sure it was the unexpectedness of it too.
Yes,
those are things that had to fall in place the right way.
Yeah,
and you know, look, let's be fair. Whenever you go into something thinking it's going to be the best day of your life, it's always the worst. That's why New Year's Eve sucks. It's when you're not expecting it, and they just things fall away, and you're like, you know what? I don't have it that freaking bad, man.
No.
I have it pretty damn good. And I think, you know, look, I don't want people to think it's that easy because of the industry, like the industries we're in, it makes it easier to be able to do these things, right? Like I've been around stars and athletes and in situations that I have no business being in, and it hardens you because what you realize is these are regular people, and what you don't do is make an ass out of yourself.
Yeah.
Stay quiet. If someone speaks to you, you speak. Otherwise, smile on your face and enjoy yourself.
Just enjoy being there.
So, that's awesome. All right, what about drink?
Drink, definitely. And it's more, you know, cocktails are cocktails.
Yeah.
And I spent 30 years in that business, 25 years. We opened at the time Marriott was opening a new brand called the Edition Hotel.
Okay.
There's one in Manhattan. We were opening a brand new one in London, downtown London. And so I went there and I got ready to order something lame, like, you know, Jameson and ginger ale or a vodka tonic or something. And the bartender goes, I have to make you my old fashioned.
Yeah.
If you're a bourbon guy, you got to have it. And just being there, it was a grand opening, all the excitement.
Yeah.
And I think it's the experience.
Yeah.
Like
an
you talk about cocktails.
Old fashioned is a very London-y drink. Old school,
and it was,
simple.
Yeah, simple. But that, for some reason, that cocktail stands out.
Do you remember the bourbon they used?
Yeah, it was Basil Hayden.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so they went lighter.
Yeah.
See, I like, if I do old fashioned, I usually go with rye.
Yeah. Because
they're already sweetening it, and Basil Hayden's a little light. So I usually go with something with some bite on the back end.
And I'm more of a bourbon in my old fashioned than a rye guy, because the traditional recipe is rye.
Is rye.
You know, that's what you should use.
Yeah.
But I said, no.
They just, my palate is bourbon. I drink bourbon on the rocks. That's really what I drink. So if I drink an old fashioned, there's too much sweetness putting in. So I like the burn of the rye to counter with the sweetness they put in.
I'll send you guys this clip. I know I sent it to you about people that have their bourbon collection and how insane they are. And it's one of the guys from SCTV. He was on Christopher Guest. No, it's like Christopher Guest. Yeah. Anyway, he comes up to a cab and he's like, "I want to talk to you guys." And he's very serious at how big people take their bourbon collection. And he opens the door. He goes, "I want to share with you my beach ball collection." He goes, "I've got 500 of them." And he talks just like it's a bourbon collection. Yeah, yeah. It's hilarious. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, I fell ass backwards into bourbon collecting. Yeah. And it was because the Heaven Hill guys are close friends of mine. And they would say, "Hey, if you go to this store, the allocated stuff is yours. Just drop the name." And I would go and I got to know the owner of the store. And I'd walk in and he'd be like, "Buy this one." I'd be like, "Dude," I go, "I don't have $1,200 to spend on bourbon." He goes, "Buy the bourbon." So I walk out and now I have, you know, I have the original, the Heaven Hill 17, the first one they ever made, which is worth $3,000-$4,000 now. I get an old
Fitzgerald. Have you cracked it open?
No, nothing's open.
You're just looking at it.
He gives me one or two bottles that he'll give me for half what they should cost that are like $100 bottles that he gives me for $50 and says, "Drink these so you don't drink these." But I don't know what the fuck I'm doing with it. I just have all this bourbon in my house. And it's something, you know, I buy bottles for my brother and my dad. My dad doesn't even drink and collects bourbon. His cabinet, because he's like a coin guy, a watch guy. I open his cabinet. Like, there's 75 bottles of bourbon here. I go, "You haven't drank in 20 years. And I look at him, I go, because I know he's collecting it to give it to me. Like, I go, "But you realize, like no one's going to ever sell this, so you're just passing alcoholism. It just skipped you."
I hadn't thought of collecting bourbon. I mean,
many people do.
Now, drum set.
It's going to fluctuate wildly.
Yeah.
But what's going to happen is, like, for example, this one I got was the first edition of what will be a 100-year collection. So it will be worth something. And then I got anniversary editions. I got a Four Roses 135.
Yeah.
So the ones that you will, if it's just a 18-year one that's allocated, it will be at the price or a little below it. It's not going to change. But those really anniversary ones, because they will be sought after for years after. You know, like baseball cards, there's a guide. There's actually a bourbon guide where you can go through the prices. Okay. It's crazy. Now, that being said, one of the reasons my affinity is to things I found, I like watches, I like cars, and I like bourbon. And the reason is because the barrier to entry is so high, right? Yeah. No one's going after Porsche, right? The watch brands, the Omegas of the world, no one's going after them. So when you buy their stuff, it will be worth the same amount or more eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that part of it, right? I don't like throwing money away on garbage. Like, if you're collecting vodka, you're a fool. Every vodka is supposed to taste the same. It's a neutral spirit.
It does. It's
by
water.
Definition, it is supposed to taste the same.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, so many tangents. All right, Joe, the spotlight's on you, bud. Best show, favorite show?
Just to finish that thought, you're collecting bourbon and watches. I'm collecting vintage drums. So as
we got a dude in museum.
I've
here.
Got a
we got Tom. What do you collect?
Drums.
There you go. Yeah. We got a dude in museum.
He went to see Bunny Carlos in Chicago with me, and I have a couple of his drum sets, and I've got, you know,
on display.
20. I've got them at home. Yeah. Cool. A couple of dozen snare drums. So Tom's line before we get to Bunny's: I am not buying a snare drum.
I'm not buying
10 minutes
drum,
into it.
I need a snare drum.
Bunny, would you take $1,000 for that snare drum? I mean, it wasn't 10 seconds. Shit. So yes. No, so, but my favorite.
We need to have a drum, bourbon, and watch expose.
We can put them all together. I'm blessed to have a Bunny drum, a Van Halen drum, a lot of really cool drums. But for me, I think as I'm sitting here today, when I would say is my most memorable concert, I've always been a huge Foo Fighters fan. My wife and I, solid parenting, we pulled our kids out of school to go see the Foo Fighters when they played here in Atlanta, and it rained and we were there. Loved the show. But I remember when Dave Grohl came out and Taylor Hawkins, and they were both wearing Claremont Lounge shirts. And again, solid parenting, you know, my kids are like looking up what the Claremont Lounge is and having all that discussion.
So, now it's a restaurant.
Yeah,
so now it's okay.
Yeah,
so it's like a tapas restaurant. There's no boobies taking off bottle tops. That's a different story for Blondie.
Yeah, Blondie's not there. But the thing that was memorable is we went, Laura and I took Aiden and Nick, our kids, and I hadn't met him yet. I knew who he was, but we're standing there and I walk just to my right and it's John Driscoll Hopkins of the Zac Brown Band, who I've now become really good friends with. I'm wearing his Hop on a Cure. But that's the first day that I met him.
Cool.
Was he's there as a fan.
Got it.
Acting like a 10-year-old that we were. And it's a guy with multiple Grammys And then, you know, so it's sort of gone full circle. We're there with my wife, there with my kids. It's a great show. And then you meet him and you're in his studio and all those sorts of things. So that's the one that stands out. Favorite drink for me is, I know you bourbon guys don't like vodka, but vodka's my drink. So I'm in London at this really small boutique hotel. In the middle of the day, shockingly, I'm sitting at the bar and in walk three Belvedere vodka salesmen.
Oh, I love Belvedere.
And so their job is to have the bartenders make them the latest, greatest, yeah, whatever cool thing is. And all they would do is stick a straw in and taste it and then hand me their drink. So I got there at lunch, and the next thing I know is
some bombed
five drinks.
Don't you have dinner reservations? So I apparently had some lost time with the Belvedere vodka salesman.
Not a boy. I had a Polish girlfriend that has fond memories. So Belvedere is my poison It's Polish. Because you go that way. That's how it works sometimes. And look, I think it's fun. That's kind of what you get out of this stuff, right? Like,
yeah.
Look, I'm not. This is not advice to younger people, but just enjoy the freaking moment, man. You shut your mouth, put a smile on your face, wander around, you can fall ass backwards into the coolest situations of your life. Don't be annoying. Don't pout. Don't be whiny, and you will enjoy it. And I didn't know that's what we were going to get out of this, but that is now the overarching lesson.
Pretty much
so
it is.
Screw it. We're leaving on that. You've been listening to The Marketing Madmen. Thanks for listening.